The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester City into the Champions League final for the first time in their history. Two for Mahrez, Foden flying down the wing, Ederson pinging 70-yard balls to feet, the blocking Ruben Diaz proving that he'd take a bullet for the president. All the while, a 36-year-old Fernandinho pokes and prods until Di Maria finally snaps and an Mbappe-less PSG implode. Who would City prefer in the final? Who will they get? We'll discuss it all. Elsewhere, will City face West Ham in the competition next year? They keep on trucking. Can you get the Premier League in Rome? And if so, how can you explain Roma hiring Jose Mourinho? It's The Guardian's 200th birthday. We've got our greatest historians on the panel and have appointed Barry the archivist. There's a goalkeeper scoring a header, some more new proposed law changes from Paul Doyle, and some very exciting news from Barry's mailbag. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Morning, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you very much. Well, I say that, I had the jab yesterday. I'm hoping to be carried by the three of you today. Paul Doyle, how are you?
Good, better than you by the sounds of it. Get well soon.
Thank you so much. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, I had the jab last week on the same day as Wilson. He suffered that night. You're suffering after your jab. I was fine because I'm strong and the pair of you are weak.
Thank you, Barry. Isn't it the case that if you're young and fit, it really hurts you?
Yeah. That was certainly my interpretation of the leaflet I got with it.
Barry?
I'm not young. I'm relevant, but I'm not young.
Anyway, Manchester City 2, PSG 0. Jamie Jackson wrote, this ranks in the top one of City displays that I've seen. They were superb front to back. Paul, I thought it was slightly closer than that. I don't know if this was City's best performance ever. I guess in terms of what it means, maybe it is.
Yeah, it was probably their most controlled performance, and the one that where they showed the most poise and an ability to do what was necessary to win in a very important match. I thought PSG were pretty good. I know they're being ridiculed, and they did lose their heads towards the end. But that generally, they were pretty good, and City had to defend very well to keep them at bay.
Wilson, you go with that? It felt quite sort of basketball-ball-y at times.
Yeah, it did. But I have to say, I didn't really think, certainly after, say, the first quarter of the game, I never really saw PSG getting back into it. There was that little spell when Marquinhos had the header to hit the bar and there was the Di Maria shot when he dispossessed Gundogan. But after that, I thought City were pretty much in control. And in control in a way that sort of we're not used to seeing them in control. You know, this was a more sort of orthodox form of defending, that they got men behind the ball. They Ruben Dias particularly put bodies on the line. There was that very good tackle from Zinchenko from Neymar late on, which they celebrated like a goal, which given Guardiola's previous sort of sceptical approach to tackling and blocking suggested a sort of a change in mentality. But you just sort of see PSG getting more and more worked up. And having seen the first leg and what happened to them then, you sort of always felt at some point they would just crack. And sure enough, they did.
Kylian Mbappe's absence was hugely significant, because not having that speed meant that PSG they didn't have the option of going over the top. So when City pressed them up the pitch, they kept trying to play their way out from the back and they couldn't do it. So it was a real shame that Mbappe was missing.
Well, that's true, but I also think it's indicative of the different approaches to team building. And I know City have spent more than PSG, but essentially two clubs with unlimited resources, or limited only by whatever belief of a better place in FFP. And PSG put it all in, or not all, but they put a huge amount in two big name, glamorous centre forwards. And the problem with that is if one of them gets broken, then you're a bit limited and it's quite easy to smother the other one. Whereas if, City, bizarrely, for a money-driven club, for a nouveau riche club, if you like, the one big absence, you'd say, in their squad is a centre-forward. And they've spread the money much more sensibly. And whatever questions you may have about the amount of money they've spent or where that money comes from, they have spent it exceptionally well.
Adam says, Riyad Mahrez is pretty good. When he went to City, did anybody think he'd be as influential as he has seemed to become in a City team loaded with stars? Baz?
I didn't. I thought he'd be a fringe player and probably end up being shipped out after a couple of seasons. You know, he came, he arrived in English football as a championship player, won the title with Leicester. But before that, he was instrumental in keeping them in the Premier League. But I certainly didn't see him having the impact he has had. But I suppose when you're surrounded by players of that quality, you are going to shine as well. And he's one of their most important players. But then last night, everyone was important. Everyone played a role. Even Ederson, who I don't think he actually had to make a save. I think PSG had 14 shots and none actually made it as far as Ederson. He was still instrumental in setting up their first goal.
You mentioned none of those balls reached Ederson. And part of that was because Ruben Dias just kept hurling himself in the way of the ball. And it's not really a skill that we discuss much, Paul. I mean, I don't know if there are players who are significantly better at doing that than others. And if it takes any more skill than just bravery.
It's funny you should say that, because I interviewed Aston Villa's Ezri Konsa earlier in the season. And he mentioned how he's been watching video clips of defenders, great defenders from the past, doing exactly that. You know, Vidic, Ferdinand, Paul McGrath, people like that. Because it is a skill, and it's more an attitude, really, that you have to have, especially if you're a defender. And it's inspirational, inspires those around you. So by dint of Ruben Dias repeatedly doing it, you saw, I think it was Sinchenko, hurl himself in front of one and then get a big group hug from his team. You know, that sort of defiance and radiates throughout the whole team, and it's essential to win. And you know, PSG actually had done something similar against Bayern in the previous round.
Yeah, City had 9 blocks last night from 6 different players, and Paul's right. It does, each one sort of it has a group an effect on the group. I think.
Can we talk about Fernandinho, Wilson? Kyle sent an email to footballweekly@theguardian.com, which goes straight to Barry. I'd love to hear the pod's opinion on Fernandinho's shithousery tonight. I was watching the Spanish broadcast. The announcer said about him never getting booked that he was getting, you know, penalised for about 1 of 8 infractions compared to PSG, followed by, forget about James Bond, licence to kill. It's Fernandinho, licence to foul. He's 36. It's amazing that someone 36 can be so important in that team.
Yeah, and you know, when the team sheet came through, I suppose there were 2 slight surprises. I mean, not massive surprises, but Zinchenko rather than Cancelo, I think, was, yeah, I was slightly surprised by, but Fernandinho rather than Rodri. But you know, I think his experience was critical, and of course, when Mark van Bommel retired, he appeared to bequeath his cloak of invisibility to Fernandinho, and that now allows him to commit fouls with impunity. And it turns out that really winds up the opposition, which is, when you're not sort of emotionally involved in the game, it's just funny to watch. But I think he's been, I loved him when he was at Shakhtar, and I've loved him at City. I think he's a fantastically intelligent, clever footballer who subtly changed his role as his pace has gone. And I did a sidebar on him. Which game was it? Did they play Everton in the cup? Is that a thing that happened this season?
Yes.
It was for that game. And so I sort of spent the game just sort of watching him. There's never anybody near him unless he's kicking them. his capacity to find space, and you know, it was a very different game, obviously, the Everton game to last night, but the Everton game, he'd have this wave of City attack. They'd come up against the Everton defence and they'd have to recycle it. And he's always there. He's always in space. He's always offering the option. And then as the game went on, in that game, he started breaking forward more. And in the end, I think he played a key role in the first goal or the second goal, one of the 2 goals that they scored late on in that game. And it's just that ability to read a game. I think he's phenomenally gifted, and we probably slightly underappreciated him. And you know, I think there's a case that we underappreciated, say, Yaya Toure, but we underappreciate Fernandinho in a different way, that he's a far less... his influence on the game is far less direct, but no less profound than Yaya Toure.
Should he be penalised more? I mean,
of course he should. Of course he should. Yeah, I mean,
so why So why is Bjorn Kuipers not spotting it?
Because you can't. The nature of the cloak of invisibility is you can't see him. That's what it means.
It's like Richie McCaw in rugby.
Explain that.
Well, Richie McCaw was the All Blacks captain, and he just had this amazing ability to get away with every foul and always come up with the ball and evade detection from whatever mischief he was up to.
Well, the difference between Richie McCaw and Fernandinho, though, is that Richie McCaw was basically an assistant referee. He was in constant dialogue with the referee, telling the referee what to do. Not only was he getting away with his own fouls, but he would be, you know, habitually pointing out members of the opposition who were fouling and should be penalised, and the ref would act accordingly. So, I mean, his cloak of invisibility was, well, I'm not sure what it was a cloak of.
A sort of Bluetooth earpiece of influence.
Yeah, we'll go with that. So Fernandinho doesn't do that. I mean, I think it's remarkable because everyone knows what he's about. So you would think referees would, on a subconscious level at least, go, right, I'm going to keep an eye on Fernandinho today, and as soon as he steps out of line, give me a yellow card. But no, he just acts with impunity, like a double O license, you know, license to foul.
He's the first on the scene to calm players down, like ostentatiously in front of the ref. Don't worry, ref, I'll defuse the situation.
Yeah, I mean, you saw that absolutely when Leandro Paredes threw the ball at Foden after he'd been fouled by Verratti, and Zinchenko got himself involved. And the bollocking Fernandinho gave Zinchenko for really not doing anything other than sort of running 5 yards. But it was a real kind of, no, that's not how you retain invisibility. You don't, you know, you're not invisible if you're running towards an opponent. So, yeah, hopefully those arts are going to be passed on to the likes of Phil Foden, and I guess it's probably too late for Kyle Walker. But
it does remind me, Barry, of, and it brings me out in a slightly cold sweat, when we were discussing Fernandinho on the radio and we suggested that he's committing tactical fouls all the time, and I think I said out loud something like, he's just
tugging people in the supermarket is what you said.
Yes, tugging people in the supermarket, but I didn't mean it like that.
But it, anyway, it led to a sort of stop it aggers moment where neither of us could stop laughing.
Can we talk about the PSG meltdown then? Do we have sympathy because Fernandinho was being such a genius? No,
it's pathetic. You know, it's just a spoilt child. You know, part of winning football matches or any sport is keeping your head. Nobody ever won a game nobody ever performed better by losing the rag completely. And to be honest, I thought Bjorn Kuipers had a pretty good game, but he really should have shown at least 2, 3, 4 red cards. And you might say, well, it doesn't matter because they went out anyway, but it does matter whoever PSG play first next season, because they shouldn't have to play against those players. And say one of those, the really bad, Danilo and Kimpembe. Mm-hmm. Both put in horrible tackles. If one of those had caused a serious injury, then I think Kuipers would be partly responsible for not having taken action earlier. It's not the kind of thing you see very often, that kind of meltdown. Yet we've seen it twice now from PSG in the space of a week.
The meltdown in the first leg was worse, really. I mean, insofar as the game was still very much there to be retrieved in the first leg. They lost their head way too early. Doing it in the dying moments of the second leg when you need 3 or 4 goals to get back into it is almost excusable. But they've had... for the commentators on British TV here, we're talking about how they're really letting down Pochettino, and it's not fair because it reflects badly on Pochettino. As if Spurs meltdown at Stamford Bridge didn't happen under Pochettino a few years ago, and that this was all totally alien to him. But the culture of indulging star players at PSG breeds this kind of attitude, and they've shown it in Ligue 1 throughout this season, where they just haven't been able to muster the enthusiasm to play matches, and they've lost, I think, 9 matches in the league this season.
Well, and you know, if you think back to the Lille game, the same thing. You're 1-0 down with 5 minutes to go, and PSG completely lost the head when they could have put on pressure and they could have nicked an equaliser. And you know, I take your point that they needed 3 goals in the last sort of half hour yesterday. But say they had got one with 20 minutes to go, this is a City side that and a coach who have regularly conceded goals in batches in key European games. If they had got one and been 20 minutes left, there would have been pressure. I don't think the way City were playing, they would have crumbled. But you can't know that. So you have to keep going. You can't. I mean, yeah, even if you're 8-0 down, you can't just go around kicking people. But I don't think the tie was entirely lost, even when Morris got the second.
No, you're right.
It's just petulant entitlement, isn't it? It's brattish behaviour, and it wasn't surprising to see it, but it's bizarre. You would think the manager would be able to nip that in the bud, but maybe he's part of the problem.
I tweeted in the first leg something like, you know, they say the beauty of football is what these big stars are doing is exactly the same as we do on a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon in the park. And this is categorically not the case because the pace of the game was so extraordinary. But I have seen so many games like that where you're winning and then the opposition are just like, we are going to get you. And then it's just about trying to get away. And it was one of those games where after the game, PSG would, none of their players would be in the bar. After one, Marquinhos would be there on his own because he'd paid for the scratch card with like a platter of chips and sandwiches. But everyone, they wouldn't even shower. They'd all get in Neymar's Fiesta and just leave straight away in a rage.
Well, even the 2 minutes of injury time felt like that. You never see 2 minutes of injury time in a normal game. That was Kuipers thinking, let's get him out of here as quickly as possible.
Herrera said after the game, the referee tonight said, fuck off to Leandro Paredes. If we say that, we get a 3 or 4 match ban. And Verratti echoed those claims. He said, the referee also told me, fuck you twice. For them, it's normal. If you say that, it's 10 matches. I talk a lot to the referee, but I don't say that. Should Bjorn Kuipers be saying fuck off to people, Paul?
Well, are we believing that the players never say this to officials? I don't think it's true. Although, in fairness, I haven't heard that much this season when we can hear what the players say. The worst I've heard is Kasper Schmeichel constantly throughout matches just shouting, referee, behave yourself! And things like that. But I haven't heard any swearing at them.
Who Wilson, do you think City would prefer in the final?
Well, I know who. I hope that Real Madrid get through, simply because I don't like having finals between two teams from the same country. I can't remember a good one between two teams from the same country. And it's also antithetical to what the European competition is supposed to be about.
What do you reckon, Wilson?
I mean, yeah, I would agree with that. But I suspect it'll be Chelsea. And I also suspect that, yeah, you know, we've seen for sort of, I don't know, 5 years, 8 years, the latter stage of the Champions League have been these incredibly thrilling, frenetic end-to-end games. And one of the reasons for that is just big teams have no idea how to defend anymore because they don't have to do it on a regular basis. But you do have to do it a bit more in the Premier League than you do elsewhere. So it makes sense that if a sort of defensive revolution was going to happen anywhere, it would be here. And I think City have looked better defensively this season than they often have in Europe. I think Chelsea under Tuchel have shown signs of that. So it there's sort of a tactical logic to it being a City-Chelsea final. And while I absolutely take Paul's point that European finals between two teams from the same nation are rarely good games, I thought that FA Cup semi-final between City and Chelsea was a really good game. So I would not object to seeing that again.
A couple of nice lines. Barney Ronay saying, if only mankind could find a way of harnessing the power of pure, uncut Kyle Walker, of storing the energy dispersed by those defensive barge sprints. And Moussa Okwonga saying, De Bruyne is just making some of these passes because he likes the trail they leave in the snow. That was nice. It's a great shame there wasn't an orange ball there. I don't know if we should take the gloss off City's win, but Tarek Panja wrote an interesting piece in the New York Times, Wilson, about Manchester City involved in a secret legal battle with the league over whether it complied with financial rules. What's your take on it?
Well, yeah, it appears to be the same period that the UEFA case was over. So between 2010 and 2014. Now, we don't know exactly what the charges are. We don't know exactly what the sanction is. The fact they've been fighting it apparently for a year suggests the sanction might be quite severe. And theoretically, at least, that could mean points deductions, which could lead to them being stripped of the 2012-2014 Premier League titles, which would mean that Aguero's last-minute goal never happened, and also Steven Gerrard never actually slipped. But who knows? That's ongoing.
Rich says, is it fair after the year we've had to have to deal with a West Ham team that are actually quite good. I'm not sure I can take any more. They won again, Barry, 2-1 at Burnley on Monday night. Mikel Antonio back in the side. And Burnley really pushed them. It was a really good game, actually. And West Ham's running isn't that tough. You know, they've got a great chance.
Yeah, they were simultaneously impressive and unimpressive against Burnley. They should have put the game to bed a lot earlier than they did, and they were left clinging on for dear life towards the end. But they weathered the Burnley storm, and hats off to Burnley, because they didn't particularly need to exert that amount of effort. They're not technically safe yet, but they are safe, really. I think they still need one win, but they may not need it at all. But, I mean, I didn't realise Mikel Antonio was going to be back for that game. I think in the pre-match team news, you know, in the day or two before the lineups were announced, there was a suggestion he might be on the bench. But he started and he scored two good goals. One converting across from the right, the second across from the left. Saeed Benrahma was excellent. Loads of good individual performances. The two Czech fellas, Suchek and Sufal, were outstanding again. I mean, they are being just revelatory signings. I don't know how much they cost, but they were pretty cheap. I would like to see West Ham finish in the top four and go into the Champions League. Just something different, isn't it?
West Brom drew with Wolves. Paul, you got the dream ticket to be at this one. You've seen quite a bit of West Brom this season and quite a bit of Wolves, I imagine. Both have had pretty disappointing seasons, haven't they?
They have, yeah. And if you look at the bare facts of it, Sam Allardyce took over West Brom in December when they were 19th, 2 points from safety. And now they're 19th and 10 points from safety. And so you might think that he's done a bad job. But in fact, he's undeniably improved them. And he hasn't quite been able to shake off the haplessness that has clung to them and meant that they haven't got the results that they otherwise deserved from some very good, decent performances. So I think if he stays there, and that's a big if, because it depends on how much backing he gets, he'll certainly lead them back to the Premier League, I would say, at the first time of asking.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we celebrate the Guardian's 200th birthday with the new archivist, Barry Glendenning. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. All right, let's celebrate the 200th birthday of the Guardian. It's today. 54,000 editions after the first one. A four-page weekly was printed in Manchester. The Guardian is older than Germany. Fish and Chips, the New York Times, the Bicycle, the State of Texas and the FA Cup. To mark the occasion, the Guardian is exploring what it means to be a work in progress for 200 years. You can be part of the celebration if you want. Paul?
Did you just claim that the Guardian is older than fish?
Well, hey, I'm just the messenger here, Paul, but I believe it is. There were no fish until 1827. The first recorded fish was a halibut off the coast of Kent in 1827. I'm not an expert in this, but I believe it is true. You could be part of this completely mythical, made-up history. There are videos, podcasts, events, including The Guardian at 200, made in Manchester on May the 11th. The first ever Football Weekly was a transcribed conversation in 1837 between a chimney sweep named Jay Wilson, a feckless Irish rogue, B. Glendenning, Lord Ronay of Lewisham, all compiled by an English dandy who spent most of the time strolling the Cinque Terre, who went by the moniker of Jay Richardson. You can read all about the actual things at theguardian.com/200. In today's show, we are inviting Barry to take on a new guise as the archivist with some choice bits from The Guardian from years past. And we have, Barry, your first reading today, if you'd like to step up to the lectern.
A large concourse of persons were congregated together on Tong Moor on New Year's Day, in expectation of witnessing at match a football between Tottington, Harwood Leys and Turton against Great Bolton, Little Bolton and Tong. Some of the players, however, did not make their appearance. Consequently, a game for a subscription purse was made up amongst those present. The playing was not so excellent as we have witnessed on former occasions, but upon the whole, the sport was tolerably good.
So, Wilson, what was going on in 1821?
What I like there is the very first match report in The Guardian saying, oh, it's not as good as it used to be. Well, I have to say, I was really surprised to find there was a report as early as 1831. The FA isn't founded until 1863, and that's when we get the laws that are the basis of the laws we have today. There was the Cambridge Laws were drawn up in 1841, which were very influential over the FA laws. So before that, football happened in various forms in various parts of the country. I think the earliest record anywhere in England of football is 1314. We know it's talked about quite seriously at the Tudor court, with Henry VIII possibly being involved in playing. It was banned at various times because it was felt that it caused huge amounts of damage and injuries, and that fit young men would be better off practising their archery. But essentially, from the early 19th century, as the public schools become taken more seriously, they begin to take games and football, that becomes part of the curriculum, and having playing fields. I think rugby's the first school to have playing fields. I think they buy them in 1812, although the famous story of William Webb Ellis, which I think is supposed to have happened in 1823, of him picking up the ball and this becoming rugby. I think that story wasn't even made up until the 1890s. But you have the public schools playing forms of football, but they all play their different type of football. And then when former pupils of those schools go to university, they end up having these huge arguments about how this game of football should be played. So that's why there's these attempts to draw up the unified laws. But the reason why schools start to play football, I think, is at least mildly interesting. And it's largely due to muscular Christianity, the idea that physical activity in and of itself is a virtue. And of course it has the benefit of supposedly preparing people for empire, for it toughens them up, it sharpens their tactical brain. But by the sort of the 1860s, 1870s, it has a very specific role. And so Uppingham School, there's a famous headmaster there called Reverend Thring, and he writes a series of sermons in which he talks about why football is so important, why it has to be part of the curriculum. And it's to stop what he calls solipsism, which is a Victorian euphemism for masturbating. So the idea was, if you let boys be by themselves and think, there's only one thing they're ever going to do. So you have to put them in big groups and get them to run about chasing a ball. Now, the fascinating irony of this is that you have this question of why does football take off at all? Why is it being played in the market towns? Shrove Tuesday was a classic day for it. New Year's Day, as we heard in that report, was holiday days. You get huge groups would gather together to play this game, which, although it has various different manifestations, would involve trying to get it into the goal. Now, often the first goal would win the game, and the ball would be a pig's bladder, or maybe it would be a sack of hay, and the goal might be a landmark, it might be a tree, it might be a stone, it might be two sticks. But often it was a hole in the ground. And one of the theories for it is it's a vestige of an ancient fertility rite. And so the placing this spherical object, or roughly spherical object, in a hole in the ground is symbolic of the fertilisation of the earth by the sun. So you then have this very strange thing that by the late Victorian period, the way you stop boys masturbating is by making them engage in a fertility rite.
Do we know if Henry VIII played in a two or in a three? You'd want him in a three.
Isn't he accredited with owning the first pair of football boots? When he died, and they went through the royal wardrobe, and he had 17,000 items of clothing, apparently, and one of them was specially made football boots. And speaking of football boots, actually, that one of the interesting things when they started to codify laws was what different bodies considered to be foul play. So in 1863, when they introduced the first 13 laws, of football, one of the laws was that you're not allowed to stick nails in your boots because people used to use them as weapons. Obviously, our gutta percha was another thing that they'd put on the end of their boots to maim opponents. And I remember a few years ago reading an account of one of the first matches between an Irish team and a Scottish team, and it was written in in an Irish newspaper. The match was sometime in the 19th century. I can't remember exactly when. But the correspondent was commending the Irish players for their expert throttling of the opponents, but referred to the barbaric Scottish practice of heading the ball, which was very uncouth.
I love the idea of Henry VIII, just some predators or some Pima Kings just going in a little boot bag. It's beautiful. Anyway, back to our...
I love the idea of a Tottington fan reading the first ever match report and then taking up his quill, dipping it in his ink and writing lazy journalism on a piece of vellum and dispatching it via messenger to Guardian Towers, ye olde Guardian Towers.
Let's go back to the archives, Barry. On Friday, the 1st of January 1915, The Guardian published a British officer's letter from the Western Front, which mentions the Christmas Day truce football match played in no man's land between the British and German troops. It started when a ceasefire was called to bury the dead. Barry.
The German soldiers seemed a good-tempered, amiable lot, mostly peasants from the look of them. One remarkable exception, who wore the Iron Cross and addressed us in slow but faultless English, told us he was a professor of German English and English dialects at a Westphalian university. He had a wonderfully fine head. They distributed cigars and cigarettes freely among our digging party, who were much impressed by the cigars. Meanwhile, the officers were amusing themselves by taking photographs of mixed groups. The Germans brought us copies to send to the English illustrated papers, as they received them regularly. The digging completed, the shallow graves were filled in, and the German officers remained to pay their tribute of respect while our chaplain read a short service. It was one of the most impressive things I have ever witnessed. Friend and foe stood side by side, bareheaded, watching the tall, grave figure of the padre outlined against the frosty landscape as he blessed the poor broken bodies at his feet. Then, with more formal salutes, we turned and made our way back to our respective ruts. Elsewhere along the line, I hear our fellows play the Germans at football on Christmas Day. Our own pet enemies remarked that they would like a game, but as the ground in our part is all root crops and much cut up by ditches, and as, moreover, we had not got a football, we had to call it off.
What do we know about the football, the match that was played? Wilson, do you know?
Well, I think it was a series of matches, sort of very ad hoc. You had footballers' battalions in the First World War, which we had to try and encourage footballers to sign up. You know, there's this sort of weird sense of warfare as a form of sport. So some officers, when they went over the top, would kick a ball ahead of them to sort of try and create that sort of spirit. So, yeah, I mean, I think the truth is we don't know a huge amount about them other than that some happened.
One more from the archives. 1958, The Guardian stopped the presses when news of the Munich air crash broke. Donny Davis of The Guardian died along with 22 others, including 8 Manchester United players. After leaving Bolton School, he played on the right wing for Northern Nomads, won his first amateur international caps in 1914, touring Austria-Hungary and Romania with England. When the First World War broke out, he served as an infantry lieutenant before transferring to the Royal Flying Corps. After only a day in action on the Western Front, he was shot down and captured before being sent to a series of prison camps. Donny helped with the construction of escape tunnels and suffered so badly from a 3-month gap between food parcels that on his return to England, weighing less than 6 stone, he was given 6 months to live. But after the war, he recovered, took up a teaching post at an apprentice's school, eventually becoming headmaster, which left his weekends free for sport. His Monday morning football essays under the byline Old International entertained readers for a quarter of a century, and his audience was broadened by his weekly radio appearances on the BBC Sports Report. When news of his death broke, a reader in South London wrote in to the paper. Barry, you have that.
Many people, including myself, although never having seen the Manchester United team, felt that we knew the individual types of play of these great footballers because of Donny Davis's outstanding descriptive writing. Byrne, Coleman, Taylor, Whelan and the others are not just names to us. We can see them coming away with the ball, sweeping it through to the player gliding into open space, firing in the unstoppable shot. They will always be alive in our imaginations because he painted their movements so vividly.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was a brilliant writer, but the extraordinary thing about that is how close he came to not being on the flight. That John Arlott, who also worked for The Guardian at the time, but you know, is now known as maybe the greatest English cricket commentator of all time, he'd been lobbying at the paper to get you know, to do more different sports to get a higher profile. And because Donny Davis was getting older, John Arlott started to do more football. So the last game Manchester United played in England before Munich was at Highbury. They won 5-4 on the Saturday before that game in Belgrade on the Wednesday. And it was John Arlott who covered that game. It's his match report. So the last match report on English soil of that team was by John Arlott. And he was supposed to be going to Belgrade. And at the last minute, he got bumped for Donny Davis. He suddenly decided that because he'd been there through Busby rebuilding the side, that he should be there for what was at the time the biggest European game to date. And Arlott was furious. And he sort of went off in a strop. And the day after the game, the Thursday, February the 6th, he sort of didn't go into the office. He was just sort of wandering around London, going to old bookshops. And then the news comes through that the plane's gone down and that Donny Davis has been killed. And so the sports editor, Larry Montagu, had to get hold of John Arlott to write Donny Davis's obituary. So he rang his wife, Valerie, who said, well, he's not here, but I know he's sort of doing a crawl of bookshops. So she rang. She basically got a map of bookshops in London and rang sort of his normal route. And eventually tracked him down at a bookshop called Bertram Rota on Savile Row and said, yeah, you've got to go in the office because you've got to write Donny Davis's obituary.
Paul, when you've been on before, you've sort of harked back to stories of footballing is it Billy Blood or someone you mentioned at some point? I just wondered if you had some classic football stories you wanted to tell us. Sort of like Jackanory, Paul Doyle's Jackanory.
Well, there's been a lot of talk this week or in recent days about English football's noble heritage and the integrity of their great sporting institutions. And so that, inevitably makes you think of the famous match in 1915 between Liverpool and Manchester United, when United needed to beat Liverpool to avoid relegation. And Liverpool performed, I just read the Guardian's match report of it actually this morning, and it's a very short match report, but in just one paragraph, but the correspondent mentions three times the poor quality of Liverpool's shooting, and even Man United famously missed a penalty by an unbelievable distance. And it was subsequently discovered that the players had arranged on a 2-0 win for United, and they'd all placed, not all, but many of them had placed bets on that result. So a lot of them were banned. And the reason for that was the context of the war. Players weren't particularly well paid at the time, and because of the war and because of the threat of them being conscripted or pressurized into joining the army, they knew that they were probably going to lose their livelihood. So they kind of thought, let's try and arrange a jackpot before that happens. And of course, some of the United players involved that day had previously played for Manchester City, including in a famous match in 1905 between City and Aston Villa, when a fight broke out at the end of the match, and the Aston Villa captain, Alec Leake, started flinging mud at a United player called Sandy Turnbull. And a punch-up ensued, and apparently then after the match, while Sandy Turnbull was in the toilet, he was ambushed and dragged into the Villa changing room and given a hiding. And there was various accounts of what were the cause of that. And it turned out, well, Alec Leake subsequently claimed that what had triggered it was that one of the United players, or one of the City players, had tried to bribe him to throw the game. And afterwards, Billy Meredith, who was accused, accused some of the City players of breaking what was effectively a salary cap at the time, some of the City bosses, making illegal payments to players. The upshot of it was that almost the entire City squad were forced to be put up on auction, and United bought some of their best players at the auction.
So the story of the auction's amazing as well, because I think it was held at the Midland Hotel, and it was meant to be starting, I don't know, like 11 a.m., But the United manager, Ernest Mangold, just turned up early and took the four best players for himself. And that's the team that goes on. They win the league in 1908 and then the cup in 1909, I think. So it's United's first two major triumphs are based on these knock-off City players they got cheap.
That's absolutely brilliant. Look, if you want more stuff from the past, including the first ever fish and that sort of discovery, go to theguardian.com/200. Like to end part two by paying tribute to the former Republic of Ireland and Portsmouth midfielder Alan McLaughlin, who's died at the age of 54. His other clubs included Swindon Town and Southampton. He revealed in March that he had cancer. He made his Republic debut in 1990, won 42 caps, and famously scored the equaliser in a World Cup qualifier against Northern Ireland at Windsor Park in November 1993, which sent Jack Charlton's men to the tournament. Barry?
Yeah, he was by all accounts an absolute gentleman, and that iconic goal against Northern Ireland in a bear pit at Windsor Park was what he'll always be remembered for. But and Portsmouth fans obviously are very fond of him, and Swindon too. His parents came over from Ireland just because they couldn't get, or his dad couldn't get work at home, and he lived on Main Road and was mates with Noel Gallagher in school. They were in the same class and they used to go to City games together, even though McLaughlin was a Man U fan. And he signed for United as a schoolboy, didn't quite make the grade, and went to Swindon after that. But this was his second cancer diagnosis. He I think was first diagnosed back in 2012. He had a tumour in his kidney. I suppose it's a mark of the man that I was reading an old interview with him in the Irish Examiner today, that when the doctor gave him his diagnosis back in 2012, he apologised to the doctor, and the doctor sort of looked at him and went, why are you apologising to me? And he said, oh, it must be awful having to break this kind of news to people for a living. He at United, he played in, he was captain of the same U team that David Platt was in, and I suppose it speaks volumes for me. He was one of few people in the world that was very good friends with Roy Keane, who I suspect is quite selective about who he invites into his inner circle.
Absolutely. One other piece of news worth discussing is a court case that's ongoing regarding the death of former Aston Villa striker Dalian Atkinson. A jury heard on Tuesday that a police officer murdered him. PC Benjamin Monk denies murder and manslaughter following the incident on the 15th of August 2016 in Telford, which began at the home of Atkinson's father. We obviously can't discuss, had a couple of tweets saying, why are you not discussing this? It's an ongoing court case, and that's why we can't talk about it. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. John says, did Jose Mourinho flee to Rome on the back of Max's meeting in the doorframe of Talksport Towers? Auckland Gunner, has Mkhitaryan put in a transfer request yet? Jose will take over as the manager of Roma next season after getting assurances that he'll have the power over transfers and time to achieve success at a club set to finish this season in seventh in Serie A. The incredible passion of the Roma fans convinced me to accept the job. I cannot wait to start next season. I don't know about anyone else. I was sort of shocked and just sort of baffled that this had happened, Barry.
Yeah, look, there's no accounting for what the owners of football clubs think are good ideas. There's every indication that, I think he's been given a 5-year deal, which you obviously can't see lasting more than two, if that, but I don't know how high the expectations of Roma fans are, but I'll be honest, I'm just glad he's not going to be in the Premier League, because I can do with a break from all the nonsense.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because you imagine that at some level he's going to be really motivated to prove people wrong. So it's a question of how does he do that? By being even more Jose than ever, or by actually adapting his methods and changing a little bit?
Jonathan, you have anything to add on Mourinho?
It's just sort of the, it's sort of, you know, very slow helter-skelter down the kind of standard of clubs he's joining. But it's that statement from the owner sort of talking about him as being a, you know, a born champion, a guaranteed winner, as if things never change. You know, as if something that was true 15 years ago is necessarily still going to be true It's extraordinary. You look at that squad. It's just full of players who were quite good in 2011. And so I guess Jose makes some kind of sense that he also was quite good in 2011. But you've got Chris Smalling, got Stefan Al-Shaarawy, Pedro, Edin Dzeko. I mean, Edin Dzeko is a proper Jose-type forward. So, I mean, it shouldn't work. And if it does work, it's an absolute indictment of Serie A as a league. But on the other hand, there is a little part of me thinks, you know, a load of sort of 30-somethings who haven't quite achieved what they might have done in the game. It is this sort of one last job shtick. So there might be some appeal to that.
Should say well done to Mark Travers, Irish goalkeeper at Bournemouth, who starred at both ends last night. Bournemouth under-21s beat Eastleigh on penalties in the Hampshire Senior Cup at Snows Stadium. He scored a header, which is absolutely brilliant bullet header from a corner, and saved a penalty in the shootout. So well done to Mark.
I think Mark began life as an outfield player. He was quite a late convert to goalkeeping.
Oh, interesting. Well, he showed every... It was an absolutely towering header. Although
that I think of it, I might be getting mixed up with Queevy and Kelleher, but they're both Irish and young, so, you know.
Paul, the Paul Doyle law, which is that penalty can be given to anybody who denies a goal-scoring opportunity, regardless of where it is on the pitch, and not all fouls in the penalty area should be given as penalties. I feel very much like I'm trying to remember Mormonism, but like you're Joseph Smith and then I'm the guy that has gone around. I've been preaching this to everybody and not a lot of people are on board with it, Paul, but I'm going to keep going.
Thank you. It's the right way to go.
Well, I completely agree. Have you got any more law changes that I could perhaps take the mantle up?
One of the most morally reprehensible things that a player can do on the pitch is deliberately put the ball out of play. It's the ultimate cop-out. And the problem with it is that they actually get rewarded from it, because when an opponent then has to go to take a throw-in, for example, the fouling team now have more players on the pitch than the one. So I think that it should be, if you deliberately put the ball out of play, and yes, that will be open to a referee's interpretation, just like with the back pass law, whether a back pass is deliberate, that's open to a referee's interpretation. So if you deliberately put the ball out of play, like a defender does when he's under pressure, you should have to go off the pitch for the next ensuing phase of play. So until the ball goes dead again, so that your team is reduced by that player.
What about the poor person who's on the floor dying? The reason the ball has been put out in the first place.
Well, that's a good point, because it would also stop that practice of putting the ball out of play for a player to get attention, which is always abused and which is always specious. The referee can stop play if a player needs attention. That's already the case.
Now, into Barry's mailbag. You're enjoying receiving all these emails, aren't you, Barry?
No, it's made my life an administrative nightmare because I can't find anything important in my email inbox.
Mark says, and this is a spoiler alert for Line of Duty, so if you don't want to know what happened, then turn this podcast off now. Mark says, I see that guy Buckles, as well as scoring a back heel for Notts County, was also the baddie in Line of Duty. thank you, Mark. Barry, good news for you with regards to Football Weekly at theguardian.com is a number of people have set you up on match.com. And you currently have 24 matches.
I had noticed I was getting a deluge of emails from what appeared to be a dating website.
Okay, will you give it a go? Imagine what a beautiful story that would be.
I want no part of any kind of dating app or website. Fine.
What if they agreed to meet you with cans on a bench in Clapham Common?
No, I've done that experiment.
I'm going to finish on an email from Alex, which is, it was definitely worth setting up the email account just for this. Alex says, it was very nice to hear heartwarming memories on yesterday's pod. I'm a long-time listener, but unfortunately my overriding memory is a bit of a disaster. In January this year, on my way home from a late shift at work, and with the pod on the car Bluetooth, I hit a pothole and then black ice, and the car went into a skid and then into a wall on a country road. I was completely unhurt, but the gearbox, steering column, fuel tank, suspension and engine were all ruined and the car written off. Despite all this damage, while sitting in the smoking ruin of my car in disbelief, I was unharmed, The pod continued on the undamaged stereo system like nothing had happened. Max continued to whine on about Cambridge United capitulating yet again. It is in some way reassuring that no matter what life throws at you, Max, Barry and the rest will continue to talk a small amount of sense and a lot of enjoyable waffle regardless. Thank you, Alex. It is a brilliant image that you've conjured up there.
Ours is the last voice you will ever hear.
We're like cockroaches. We'll survive a nuclear apocalypse. Anyway, thanks so much for your time today. Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.